The Orange FM.
Ready to form Voltron. Activate interlocks. Dinotherms connected. Infracell up. Mega thrusters are go.
Welcome, Voltron fans. This is Mark Morrell, and this is Let's Voltron, the official Voltron podcast. And we're here this week, and we got a special show for you today. And I'm here with Mike French. Mike, how you doing?
Not bad. How have you been, Mark?
I'm doing great. We had a funny thing happen this week. You know, first of all, the Olympics started, right? Have you been watching it?
I've been keeping up with it a little bit, yeah.
Okay, well, here's the thing that I noticed, okay? I was looking at those five Olympic rings. And I was seeing that there was one that was red, one that was blue, one that was yellow, one that was green, and one that was black. And I was thinking to myself, that's Voltron.
Yeah. If only he was there to make the event more interesting.
Yeah. And I was thinking to myself, you know, what would it be cool if we could do like an Olympic event with Voltron and the Robeasts, and Voltron would be our Olympic champion?
Yeah, I would personally like to have two contenders in our team. I'd like to have Voltron and Vehicle Voltron. You know, you always got to have a few members on your squad to go up against the other nations of the universe. So.
Yeah, but the other thing that happened this week was pretty funny. All right, we were getting some Twitter chatter that was going on. And people were remarking about how they had thought that the original Devil's Due publishing series that came out, there was a mini series that came out in 2003 that had issues 0 through 5.
Right.
And that was followed up by another 11 issue series. And these were all written by author Dan Jolly.
Right.
All right. So the people online were saying, hey, you guys should interview Dan Jolly. And then, of course, they used his Twitter handle. And then all of a sudden, you know, it got into it. And Dan said that he'd be willing to come on the podcast. So we would like to introduce Dan Jolly, the author of those original Devil's Due Publishing Voltron series. Welcome, Dan.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So what did you think about the fans actually, you know, coming out and saying how much they adored, you know, the work that you did back then?
That was kind of amazing. I was not really aware that that there was this thriving Voltron fan fiction community. Like the first I was even aware of that was like two weeks ago. And then somebody online remarked that the work that I had done was being considered canon, like the best version of Voltron to use for composing fan fiction in this universe. And I was just taken aback, you know. It's kind of made me go, huh, I had no idea.
Right.
I mean, it's cool. It's incredibly flattering. I mean, that was a massive ego boost. I was just surprised.
Well, another nice thing that I thought was going on here was that just last week, Mike and I had talked about the original first four episodes of Voltron, Defender of the Universe, when it came on TV back in 1984.
Mm-hmm.
And that storyline crosses over with your storyline from your comic issues.
Well, yeah. What I was trying to do was basically unite the Vehicle Voltron story and the Lion Voltron story in a way that I thought made sense. And that's you know, I was trying to keep as much of the source material as I could and, you know, treat it with respect, but just sort of do something that I thought would be a new take on it and a little bit more just generally realistic take on it. That was my goal.
It's funny that you bring that up because, you know, with all the discussion that we've been having just now about the fan base really adopting your work versus the other incarnations that have come out, they say that this is the real springboard for the continuity. Do you think that has something to do, Dan, with the fact that your continuity, your story, how do I say this? It matured with the original Voltron fan base in the sense that you allowed Voltron to grow up around the same storytelling range as the original Voltron fans, whereas other continuities like the Voltron Force show and some of the other properties that have come out related to Voltron that consider themselves after the original show are still more kid oriented. They're still more. I was just kind of thinking about that, and that yours really does mature Voltron as a series.
Yeah, I think there's part of it, like you're saying, the audience matured. You know, because I was watching Voltron in 1984 mm-hmm. when it came out. I was an enormous fan. I mean, I came home from school one day and turned on the TV, and there was this thing called Voltron that I didn't know anything about. And I started watching it, and I was thinking, oh, holy God, what is this? You know, I've never seen anything like this before, because I lived in a very, very small rural town in Georgia and did not have cable. In fact, I think it was right after we finally got cable that I had a turn on a station that was showing Voltron. But before that, my exposure to cartoons had largely been just Saturday morning standard fare. Mm-hmm. Where nothing really bad ever happened. Nobody was ever really in danger.
Right.
And then I started watching Voltron. And, you know, I could tell that this was an adaptation of a Japanese cartoon. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty clear to me that even though it had been adapted for American audiences, there was some brutal stuff going on. There were really serious high stakes risks here,
right.
And I just fell in love. I was just fascinated with the whole thing. So yeah, then you know, cut to 15 odd years later, and Devils Due offered me the chance to come in and basically do whatever I wanted to. With Voltron. I mean, we had to get approval from World Events, but I've done a pretty good amount of licensed work, and World Events was the coolest licensor I'd ever worked for.
Wow.
I mean, I think at one point they said, you should have the characters smiling more. and that's the only note from them that I remember. I'd send in my proposals for stories, and they'd come back and say, "Yep, sounds good. Do that." It was me as an adult trying to basically capture the essence of what I fell in love with as I guess I was 13 in 84.
That's
I don't
amazing.
Know if that answered the question. I just
no, started... it totally did. That's amazing, and it really speaks to. Why I think the fans embrace it because, I'll just draw a parallel here. The reason that Nintendo right now is falling behind is because a lot of people feel like Nintendo did not grow up with their original fan base. They continue to stay in the romper room arena of video gaming, and other video game systems said, "No, come along with us for the ride. We will grow up with you." And it seems to me that your Voltron comic series grew up with the fan base. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate you talking about that a little bit.
Right.
Yeah. You know, this is the kind of stuff that I started doing. I had given a pretty good amount of thought to Voltron in the intervening years between when I stopped watching it and when I all of a sudden got the chance to start creating parts of it and adding to it. So I really just wanted to tell the same story, but in a way that made sense to me, you know, because I know that the original show, like I said, it had to be adapted I know that it was sort of spliced together from two different unrelated series. And I know that to accomplish what they did, the people in charge of the show at the time had to make a certain number of compromises because they could not create any new animation. So they had to make sort of a patchwork that worked. And I just thought, well, okay, I don't have to stick with what was presented. You know, now that we can come up with new stuff, what would fit best? What would work best? What can I do that makes it so that the weird continuity errors never happen? what can we do to take the parts of the show that even at 13 I found kind of baffling and make it all make sense? And so that's one of the reasons why there were never any tutus on the mice. Ah.
And Pidge kind of described those mice as like synthetics, right?
Yeah, they're little robotic creatures.
Right. So you had to create some pretty big backstories for each of the members of the Voltron Force, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they didn't have any, did they?
Right. So where were your thoughts coming from when you said, okay, I'm going to come up with Keith and Lance and Hunk and you know, how somehow make them into misfits that don't really have anything to lose or anything, you know, they don't have any family or anything that they'd be turning their backs on or anything like that. How did that come about?
Well, it was kind of I guess it's a sort of a trope. The assembly of the team, and it's been used in everything from like the Magnificent Seven to, and I can't believe I'm going to reference a Michael Bay film in a positive light. it was in Armageddon, I believe, where we got introduced to each of the members of the mining crew.
Uh-huh.
It's a really enjoyable sequence. Getting a glimpse of each of the characters in sort of their natural habitat. And I was figuring that a team that was going to go do this amazingly crazy thing would need to be a bunch of misfits. And so knowing that they were going to be misfits made it easier to come up with the general backstory. Probably the only one that didn't really fit that mold was Hunk. Because, you know, he had a pretty good family, and there was no indication really that he was socially maladjusted. He was just somebody who fit the profile of the skills that they needed. But everybody else, you know, Lance was so cocky that it had landed him in prison. Pidge was getting the crap kicked out of him at school every day. And, you know, what school kid? There was a lot of wish fulfillment for me in Pidge's character there, because what school kid who was having a terrible time at school and feeling really out of place wouldn't just absolutely love for somebody like Hawkins to show up and say, "You are exactly the person we need. You are so valuable that we're going to focus all this attention on you and give you the chance to go off and do something amazing."
All right. Well, wasn't the reason that Pidge really wanted to jump at the chance of this is that at the time, he was a target of like hazing and physical abuse and stuff like that?
Yeah. I don't know if it came through in the art the way I intended it to, but the first time we see Pidge, he's got a great big black eye. His right eye is supposed to be like blackened and swollen. As this was supposed to be an indication of the fight, the most recent fight that he'd been a part of.
And that was just mostly people that were jealous of his smarts and his abilities, right?
Well, yeah, and he's a little guy, you know, and little guys tend to get picked on. Not all of them, but it's, you know, anything that kids can use to make you a target, they will.
So when it came to the question, he's like, "Let me think about it." All right, sure, let's go.
Right. Anywhere but here.
Now, one of the things that Hunk did once they got together was you could tell that because Hunk had sort of similar expertise from the mechanical side, and he was sort of like a master's in engineering, right? That they were able to get together on that level, and at the same time, Hunk being the bigger man and Pidge being the smaller man, Hunk almost felt like a protector of him, right?
Yeah, I definitely wanted to present them as sort of a pair of buddies, you know, and when it came down to it, Pidge was smarter, a little bit smarter than Hunk, and so it was a nice, I thought it was a nice, I don't know if I'd call it a dichotomy or a juxtaposition, one of those fancy words, that, you know, Hunk is the much larger, much more physically imposing guy, but he recognized that Pidge's intellect was something to respect. So, yeah, I tried to pair them up as definitely as friends and, you know, maybe like big brother, little brother.
And the funniest thing about Hunk from your version is that he was the smallest of five boys, and that's how he got his nickname.
Yeah. I really enjoyed seeing a couple of his older brothers show up later in the series.
They were huge.
He was the little guy in the family.
Right. Now, Keith, all right, he had actually come from a Japanese father and Chinese mother, and both of his parents were killed in an accident when he was 12. And then he became a Marine at 18, and then at 24, he actually got engaged.
Yeah.
And, unfortunately, she died in a plane crash before they got married.
Right.
So when Hawkins came for him, you know, he really didn't have a whole lot going on other than being like a kung fu instructor, right?
Yeah. He was having some serious problems with depression. You know, he had sort of withdrawn from the world. That was why Hawkins decided that he was a pretty good fit for this, not only because of his leadership skills and his combat expertise, but also because he wasn't even really a part of life on Earth at that time. So, you know, he wasn't really going to miss it.
Right. Now let's talk about Sven.
Okay.
All right. Sven Holgersson, he was in an elite Navy squad that was similar to the SEALs, and they had him on administrative leave when Hawkins came to get him.
Right.
And there was a whole backstory about an insurrection in South America, and he was supposed to extract a foreign national, and there was some bad communication. The foreign national fired upon him. He fired back and killed the foreign national. And so they put him on administrative leave. They didn't know what to do with him. And that's when Hawkins and Brown came in.
Right.
What do you think his feelings were at that point?
Oh, man, he's sort of the really dedicated misanthrope of the group. He's never really gotten along with people. And I think that even though he would never have admitted it at the time, I think being given the chance to rejoin a team of some kind and go and accomplish something, do something positive, he was dying to do something like that. You know, he knew that he had completely fouled up this mission that he'd been sent on, and he always covered everything with just anger. That was the side of him, the face that he showed the world, was just angry all the time.
Right.
But I think that he definitely wanted to be a part of something larger, wanted to do good things, and that was why it was just doubly devastating to him once they all got to Eris, and then the thing that he went there to become a part of spat him back out.
Okay, so we come to Princess Alora.
Mm-hmm.
And she, when she was younger, because, you know, she was alone, she was the only child, she was enjoying the companionship of children of dignitaries that visited Eris at the time.
Right.
And, of course, the space mice. And then one of those dignitaries was actually King Zarkon, and he brought Prince Lotor. So Prince Lotor and Princess Alora knew each other from that respect.
Yeah.
And that's a really cool backstory there, right there. But then when Zarkon started annexing worlds and Eris was one of them, her people were driven underground. And then her parents were executed. And then she just became this angry and determined woman that renounced her role as princess, and then swore that her people would be liberated. But she was having nighttime dreams with her father, King Alfor, right?
Yeah, a little touch of Hamlet in there, I guess you could say.
Now, that was an interesting way to bring the ghost of Alfor into it, you know, in a different respect than the original series.
You know, that was just part of the whole attempt at keeping as much of the original source material as I could in a way that was cohesive and made sense to me.
Right. So she sort of knew from her father that there were going to be five young men that came to Arras to help them.
Right.
And when they eventually did, it was sort of like a crash landing, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So now we're getting to the part where we actually see this whole thing with the Voltron Lions for the first time. But when these five guys were brought together and they were sort of misfits, and Hawkins and Brown were telling them that the whole story of the legend of Voltron, they really didn't believe that they thought Hawkins was crazy, right?
Well, yeah. If anyone at that point had heard of Voltron, it was mentioned in the same breath as other mythical things, you know, elves and fairies and manticores and whatnot. Oh yeah, and Voltron, there's that crazy myth from whatever that backwoods planet is.
So he was on the same line as like a Rumpelstiltskin.
Right.
Okay. When they actually got to Arras finally and for the first time, they went inside an ancient tomb that hadn't been opened in like 1,200 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they see Green Lion.
Right.
Wow, Hawkins was crazy, but he's right.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know if I'm bringing up something that will just open a can of worms or voicing something that other people have already thought about. But I never really addressed how Hawkins came by this information.
Right.
And I think were I ever to get the chance to do anything else with this, that would be one of the things is I would love to do a story just about Hawkins and how he finds out that this mythological thing might be real.
Oh, that would be cool. I'm sure that would be something the fans would love. All right, so going forward, then the Drools start attacking at that point, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Keith and Sven and the rest are trying to attack the Drool ships. They're able to knock out a couple of them and then take over those ships. And then in the course of going after some of the other Drool ships, they find the other Lions.
Right.
And who's the first to get into one of the Lions?
Oh, that's Pidge.
Yeah. He figures it out.
He's smart.
Yeah. So once the others hear that he's gotten into the line and everything, and they're able to disable the Drools long enough, they come back together again, and they discover the secrets of the keys and everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's still a missing fifth key, though, isn't there?
Yeah, and you know, I was listening to the podcast that you guys did talking about the first four episodes.
Oh, what did you think of that?
And oh, it was great. It was great. And you know, this is all like 11 years ago for me, and I had only just started to get my head back into the Voltron space really once the fans on Twitter started talking about doing this podcast. And you know, in the comic that I wrote, the mice have the fifth key in the base of their cage. And I had forgotten that the mice also knew where the fifth key was in the cartoon.
Uh-huh. So without even realizing it, you actually did a similar thing?
Well, no, at the time it was very deliberate. It had just stayed behind in the intervening 11 years.
Dan, how did you strike that balance? I mean, when you're reimagining this, and I mean, obviously, you said you were clearing up some continuity things and filling in some gaps that they had limitations on the original animation for. But how did you go about in your mind saying, okay, this is my line in the sand. This is where I won't overstep, or this is not overstepping. How did you figure out those boundaries? Like, I need to make this similar. I need to make sure this element or this plot twist is still in there, but over here I'm free to play. Like, how did you do that and feel like you were in the safe zone?
I really just sort of had a mental list of all of the parts of the show that I thought were crucial. And I guess I kind of, in my head, laid them all out like pieces of a puzzle. And in trying to come up with a modernized story that was consistent, everywhere I could, I plugged in one of those pieces. Loved the characters of Zarkon and Hagar and Lotor. Knew I had to have them in there, but the way Drool society was set up in the show didn't make as much sense to me as the way I did it in the comic book. I cannot take credit for the mice being little robotic creatures for that. Marie Kroll, that was her suggestion. That was the part of what I did that that she can take full credit for. My original thought was to have them still be little actual mice and make Allura able to communicate with them. Like, that was going to be just kind of a talent that she had, was this sort of empathic connection to animals. At the time, Marie said, you should make them little robots. And I thought, well, yeah, that would work, wouldn't it? Even if they had been actual organic mice, they still would not have danced around in tutus.
I think that was a very wise choice.
Yeah, that was a good choice.
That was my line that I wasn't going to cross. No mice tutus.
So the silliness aspect of it, you were taking out, and you were making it a little bit more mature.
Well, and you know, I wanted to keep some humor in there as much as I could, and for some reason, later on in the series, the group is infiltrating a galaxy garrison base. And they're posing as heating and air conditioning repairmen because there have been some glitches in the air system. And mm-hmm. they get inside, and the little robotic mice come out of an air duct, and Pidge picks them up and says, "Who's a little glitch in the air system? You are. It's you." And that just makes me laugh even today reading it. So I mean, I didn't want it to be like dour and humorless, but I didn't want it to be silly.
Yeah, but it was getting really cool at that point because after they had discovered Voltron on Eris and everything, then the Galaxy Garrison sort of did something behind the are we calling them the Spacer Explorers, or are we calling them the Voltron Force at this point?
I don't know that they ever actually called themselves anything in particular. I would call them the Voltron Force, yeah.
Right. So they found out that the Galaxy Garrison had done something behind their back and had, like, stolen Voltron.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to go back and get him, but when they went back to get him, they found out that the Galaxy Garrison was trying to create their own copy of Voltron.
Yeah, that allowed me to basically unite the two concepts, because the two shows that produced the Lion Voltron and the Vehicle Voltron had nothing to do with each other when they were first created.
Right.
That was, I thought, a pretty convenient and fairly neat way to tie in the two, that the Vehicle Voltron had been reverse engineered from the Lions. But I think it says in the comics that they couldn't duplicate all of the Lions' technology, and the sort of neural meld that the pilots used to control the machines, the Lions were about three times more efficient at that. So that's why they had to have 15 pieces instead of 5.
Pidge even remarked that when he first got in the Green Line, it was the easiest and smoothest,
right,
you know, that he ever felt piloting anything.
Yeah. Well, I think at that point I had been a little bit influenced by the old Clint Eastwood movie Firefox.
Oh, Wow.
Because he got to this this experimental Russian prototype, and the weapons system in that plane was activated by thought. Of course, in that movie, the trick was you had to think in Russian. But I just thought that was incredibly cool, and that was probably somewhere in the back of my head when I was proposing that instead of just pushing buttons and pulling levers and stuff, that the pilots' minds were directly linked to the lions.
Right. Wow. That's cool, because in the story you actually go through the backstory of how scientists and priests came together to form the original Voltron.
Oh yeah, yes, you're right. Yeah, I was thinking about the counterspell that prevented Voltron from getting destroyed completely.
Right. That was after that part, but the original creation of Voltron.
Yeah.
I mean, going back, you know, a long time, and then they actually talk about the story of how it wasn't Hagar that put that curse on him that blew him apart. It was I guess an ancestor of Hagar.
Yeah, Sarga.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was one of the things that the timeline didn't really make. It didn't flow. Like talking about this legendary mythological war machine. When Voltron was created, it seemed to be so long ago that it didn't make any sense to me that it was the same witch. And I always like to call her Hagar, because Hagar makes me think of Hagar the Horrible from the comic strips.
Yeah.
Which is why I spelled her name with two G's in the comic. But yeah, it didn't make any sense to me that was actually her that went and blew apart Voltron in the first place. So that's why I made it an ancestor of hers instead of actually her, because the timelines didn't match.
But at one point there, Hagar was actually talking to her ancestor in a similar way that Alfor was talking to Allura, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So she had that communication to that far off and distant time.
Yeah. And, you know, Hagar is revealed to be a member of a race called the Wyverns. And I wanted to at least imply that they have sort of an ancestor worship spirituality thing going on.
Wow. There was a part where the storyline for Sven goes off a little bit differently than what it did in the original series. And then also the love triangle between Lance and Allura and Keith was also, you know, explored.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd kind of like to get into those at least. And then we'd like to get into some questions by some of the fans. Okay. Is that all right?
I'm at your disposal.
Okay. So let's talk about Sven, all right? At some point, there's a lot going on. Some of this is happening while he's sleeping, that he's getting these thoughts in his head.
Yeah. And that's coming from the combined efforts of Hagar and Queen Merla.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved this take on Merla. I loved the character designs. She's just incredibly hot and incredibly just out and out wicked. I just thought she was great.
Yeah, she was on the cover of one of the issues.
Mm-hmm.
That was a great image. The whole idea is that they're trying to turn Sven over to their side.
Mm-hmm.
And do they succeed?
They kind of succeed, yeah. They do. They do. And it's revealed later on that probably the reason why the Blue Lion rejected Sven, and maybe the reason why they were able to exert this mental influence over him, is that he has some kind of actual physical brain defect. There's something that isn't quite right, and that's why he couldn't pilot the Lion. And, you know, he always maintains in the story, no one is controlling me. I'm making all these choices myself. And I don't think in my mind that was the case. I think he actually was being manipulated because of this weakness, but he just hates the idea that he has anything like a weakness. So that's
right.
I think that's why he was rejecting this thought that other people were controlling him.
But the rest of the team wasn't giving up on him at all, though, right?
No. And they never did.
And it had to be in their mind, too, that it wasn't him that was doing this. It was something else controlling him.
Definitely. Yeah, and I wanted to present them with a pretty daunting choice, you know, because they, with everything that Sven knows about Eris and its defenses and like a lot of the weapon systems that he designed himself, he was such a high value target, if you will. You know, if they couldn't get him back, they knew they were going to have to kill him.
And, yeah,
that was like a lesson that I was putting into action that one of my earlier comic book editors back at DC Comics had driven into my head. The kind of dilemma that you want your protagonist to be put in is that he or she cannot do something, and yet they must.
Right.
And I really wanted to put them into that rock and a hard place kind of position.
Right. Going through the rest of the series, there was this love triangle that was developing between Lance and Allura and Keith.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, from the start, it seemed like Allura, you know, called out Keith and said, you know, I need to talk to you right in the beginning. And right at the beginning, it's like, what do you mean? What do you mean you're the commander? You know, because these guys had come together as a misfit team, and they had never said that there was a leader of this team.
Well, I think Keith was always in charge of the team.
Okay,
I think at the beginning, you know, they each have their roles. There's the pilot, the gunner, the engineer, the science officer, and I think Keith was always basically the commander of the team. But you know,
do you think there was some jealousy of that though, on Lance's part?
I don't think Lance was ever jealous of Keith's leadership role.
Okay,
because most of these guys were soldiers. And, you know, that's just part of being in the military is recognizing chain of command.
Right.
But, you know, I think there's an actual line in there where Lance interrupts Keith and Allura talking. And he says, hey, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to screw anything up there. And Keith says, you didn't screw up anything, and walks off. Because Keith is like Mr. Stoic, tortured, you know. Keith is always thinking, I shouldn't allow myself to be happy. I should still be in mourning.
Uh-huh.
And Lance goes, he says to himself, well, if you're not interested, you know, obviously, well, then I'll pursue Allura myself. But even though I love Lance, I think he's a great character, I don't think he ever really had a chance.
Right.
Just because, you know, at one point Allura says in a very real way, she's about to say, you're the man of my dreams, because she actually had prophetic dreams.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I think she kind of sees Keith as the soul of the team. You know, when she thinks about the Voltron Force, he's front and center.
Right.
So, yeah, it's a fun dynamic to play with, but I don't think Lance's chances are very good.
Yeah. So, we have, you know, a large contingent of fan fiction people out there that are for the whole Keith and Allura storyline.
Right.
And they would like to see, you know, that relationship go on and develop through either the comics or animated shows or any other way that they can.
Well, you know, if World Events is interested, I would be more than happy to come back and write more Voltron stories.
That's pretty good, because actually that was one of the questions that some of the fans had sent in.
Yeah.
Was would you be willing to come back and do more if they had asked you to do more Voltron again?
Oh yeah. I mean, it wasn't my idea to stop doing it in the first place.
So how did that relationship happen towards the end of after that, like, 11th issue?
The sales were too low and Devil's Due canceled it. I mean, that's the long and the short of it.
Okay.
They said that the sales weren't there, and There were opinions as to why that might have happened, and I don't want to get I don't want to paint anyone as being overly acrimonious, but I thought that there could have been efforts made to reach a broader audience, so that maybe sales could have increased.
Right.
But those efforts were not made.
Okay.
Dan, can you tell me a little bit about your experience with the comic industry in 2003 versus now? If you've still been doing work with comics, and how has the industry changed as a writer and a storyteller in that 10-11 year period? I mean, is it better now or is it worse?
I'd say it's just different, because now the whole digital publishing thing is a thing, and it was not in 2003. I mean, the very thought of releasing comics digitally back then, if I don't know if anyone was doing it at all, but it was not viewed as like the wave of the future, definitely. And people can create so much more freely now. You know, anybody can create a website and put a comic on it and potentially build a huge audience. It can be challenging to monetize that. It's a pretty daunting task to ask an artist to draw like volumes worth of material for no compensation. I know there are people that do it, but I don't know the landscape. I don't know that it's better or worse. It's just very different now.
I see.
And you know, I started getting published in. I sold my first script in 1990, I think. I've always been of the traditional publishing route. You know, it's always been me approaching a publisher or a publisher approaching me, and that's how I make my living.
Right.
So I've never really tried to just create something and put it out there and see what happens. I sort of did that once. I had a novel that I put up on a blog, but there are things happening with that novel now, and I took the blog down. So even that's gone. So I mean, I don't know. I sort of feel like a dinosaur sometimes. That people ask me, well, how do you break into comics? And these days, I don't know. I mean, I can tell you how I broke into comics, but that was 23 years ago.
Sure.
Okay. So it doesn't really apply.
Right.
All right. So would you like me to ask some of the questions that some of the fans have asked?
Sure.
All right. Let's start with Sean Montgomery. What was the hardest part about taking familiar characters and giving them a new identity with the backstory, last names, etc.?
I guess the hardest part was just trying to make sure that what I put out there, that the fans were going to embrace.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no way that I could tell. You know, it was just I had to use my own best judgment. And that was kind of bolstered a bit because world events didn't object to anything that I did. But there's always the worry. I think something is really cool. Does the rest of the world think it's going to be, or will they think it's cool, or will this specific fandom think this is cool? And in the run up to the launch of the Devil's Due series, they encouraged me and the artists to get on their message boards and interact with fans as much as possible. And I began to describe kind of the approach that I was going to take with this. And you would not believe the backlash that this garnered. There were Voltron fans from all over the world who were convinced that I was going to screw this up beyond repair, that I did not know what I was doing, that in fact, if I had done anything other than a word-for-word, frame-for-frame, faithful adaptation of the show, that it was going to be horrible.
Wow.
There were a couple of people in general, or not in general, a couple of people specifically on the message boards that everything I put on there, you shouldn't be allowed to touch this property, you don't know what you're doing, you're going to screw it all up, You're going to ruin this show. This was a huge part of my childhood. This was the best TV show ever made. And you suck.
Whoa.
And, you know, it was, that was kind of my introduction to, dealing with fans on the web, and especially dealing with fans in message boards. And, it was kind of, it was definitely a learning experience. And, it was right around that time, maybe a year later or so, when I did the relaunch of the DC Comics character Firestorm. And the backlash for that was even greater. And the fans on the DC message boards told me that I was a well, let's see, what's the language rating on this show?
it's PG.
Okay, yeah, they told me that I was a bleep bleep hack, and I bleep bleep sucked, and that I shouldn't even be allowed to write bleep bleep checks.
Wow.
Do you think a lot of that, Dan, is internet courage? Because I get I get beaten up all the time about the videos I make. You know, I've never officially relaunched a character or characters in pop culture like you have. So I can only imagine the magnifying glass of heat that you were under. But is it internet courage?
Well, yeah, it totally is. It totally is. When dealing with the Voltron fans, we actually managed to convert the most vicious of them. Rather than the, 'cause I tried to explain again and again and again, we're not going to be ruining the property. We're not going to be screwing it up and messing with your childhood. We're just going to think of it as like an enhancement of it. And engaging with a couple of the most vicious people on there, we converted them to our cause, and they started being just like polite, pleasant people to interact with. On the DC boards, I was never able to do that. And I finally said, tell you what, guys, I'm going to be at the Chicago Wizard World Convention on this date, at this time, at this booth, at this table. Come and say this stuff to my face. I dare you.
Oh, man.
Guess how many people showed up?
One?
That's one greater than the actual number.
Wow.
Gotcha. Yeah, I'm glad to hear you say that's the case, because you know, you have to call their bluff, and it's an interesting dynamic to me, so I just had to ask.
And how does it make you feel now, Dan, that everybody's saying, well, your stuff is the stuff that we really loved, and it was brilliant, and you know, this is what we're using as our Bible?
It's incredibly flattering, and I kind of feel vindicated.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, once the series began to come out, a lot of the fans wrote to Devil's Due and posted on the message boards, and they said, hey, this is actually pretty good. But to hear that this version is considered by some to be sort of like the definitive version, that's really gratifying. I'm it's just awesome. I don't want to get giggly here, you know, and emotional, but it's really nice. Well, I really appreciate it.
Did you know back when you made these 11 issues that started with number one, Revelations, that they had made a motion comic animated DVD out of that series?
No one told me. The only reason I ever knew about it is that I was just flipping channels one night, and bang, there it was on the screen. That was after I had parted ways with Devil's Due. And I didn't even know what to make of it.
Yeah, for those of you listening to the podcast right now, this is from Eagle One Media. It's a DVD video called Voltron Defender of the Universe Revelations. If you don't have it, I recommend it, because I have a copy of it and I've watched it, and it's actually interesting. All right. And I know you probably have some opinions about you know, because it's a motion comic and everything, they had to put voice actors in there. What did you think about that, Dan?
I only saw one episode, and at the risk of offending people that I shouldn't offend, I was not impressed with the voice acting. I thought that they could have done a much better job with that.
So
that being said, I did think it was awfully cool that somebody had taken the time to do this.
Yeah, it was a different concept. I mean, you have different options when you get into the DVD. It's sort of like you can either watch the whole thing with motion animation and voice acting and there's no bubbles, or you can watch the whole thing with the bubbles of text.
Okay, I didn't even know that. Right. I mean, the only part of it that I saw was, I think it was on the Sci-Fi Channel, and that didn't have any of the speech bubbles. It was just like, I think it was, I don't know if it was in issue one or issue two, but the scene that really struck me is when the team has crash landed and Allura rides up on her horse looking all badass.
Right.
And she says, there's one name that you can say that will let me know that you're like the people I need to talk to. And I was trying to depict that in the comics as this really dramatic sort of moment where, you know, it's like the everything is hushed and maybe there's a little bit of dramatic music. And Keith says, Voltron. And she says, oh, my God, because she knows that these are the people that her father was telling her about in the dream. And in the motion comic, what I was seeing on the TV, the Keith character just goes, Voltron. You know, I thought, that takes care of the drama in that situation.
Yeah, they could have been expanded a little bit more, but they had the two heads coming together almost like they were going to kiss.
Yeah.
And they got close enough, and then he said, Voltron.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I just thought that fans who haven't had a chance to check that out, it's another way to look at the comics, which was really interesting. And the other thing is it does give all your character bios on it as an extra bonus.
Oh, does it?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
There's a comic issue cover gallery, and there's the comic, the character bios, and then there's two versions of how you can see it.
Okay. Yeah, that is pretty cool.
So going back to the fans' questions,
mm-hmm.
Cubbyberry wants to know, all of the K&A fans, all the Keith and Allura fans would love to know, if you were to continue the Voltron universe, what would happen to canon pair Keith and Allura?
Well, I'm of two minds about that, because I always thought that they were destined to be together. And, you know, you spend a lot of time with like watching a pair that you're really rooting for and you're really hoping they're going to get together. But if you let them get together, then a lot of the time it falls apart, like the drama falls apart. I don't know if a lot of the audience are old enough to remember the show Moonlighting.
Yeah, I remember that.
Bruce Willis and Cybill Shepherd.
Right.
And that show built their sexual tension up for years. And the second that they finally did get together, the show fell apart.
It was kind of like the Lois and Clark problem.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, as like the fan part of me would say, yes, Keith and Allura are going to get together. They're probably going to get married. You know, he's going to... She's going to tell him that he's going to have to get used to the title of king, and he's going to say, no, call me something else. I'm not meant to rule a planet. You know, the fan part of me wants to see them live happily ever after. The writer part of me wants to just keep throwing rocks at that relationship. Because the first rule of drama is that conflict is interesting.
Right.
And even though it might cause you some great distress to see them with obstacle after obstacle thrown in their way, it would also keep you coming back for more.
Yeah.
So if I were to continue the series, the story, a couple of things I think would probably happen or be hinted at happening. One of them is it would turn out that Keith's fiance did not actually die in that plane crash. That she was presumed dead because the crash was fiery and there were no survivors, but it would turn out that she was still alive. And, you know, that would probably happen right around the time that Keith finally agrees to marry Allura, but before the wedding, and then he finds that out, and, you know, he's nothing if not honorable. And he would feel like the commitment that he made to, I believe her name was Beverly, that he would have to honor that. And, you know, if she's still alive and they're reunited, are his feelings still going to be there? Or has he emotionally moved on? You know, that would be definitely something that I would want to explore.
Beverly Hagel.
Yeah.
Is that just a name you drew out of the air, or how did you come up with that name?
No, that is a name I picked out of the air.
Okay.
I've never really been much of one for names to have a lot of significance. They do now and then. Like, for instance, Pidge's last name, Stoker. That's not because of Bram Stoker. That's because my grandmother's maiden name was Stoker.
Oh.
Every writer does this. Every writer puts parts of him or herself into the characters. That story that Lance tells about when he accidentally drag raced a cop, that happened to me.
Okay. I didn't know that.
I was the dumbass in that situation. on the other side of things, away from Keith, I would probably see about rigging up a political necessity, whereby in order to maintain peace in that sector of the galaxy, and in order to ensure that Eris was never going to be attacked again, I would have a politically arranged union between Allura and Lotor.
Ooh.
And, you know, then instead of her being torn between a former love and Keith, then it would be her having to pick the safety of her planet over Keith.
Wow. That's interesting.
So, yeah, and you know, I love those two, and as a fan, I would just be squirming. But as a writer, yeah, I would just want to make things as hard for them as possible.
Okay. Drowning Blonde wants to know, what inspired you to change Hagar into Wyvern alien species?
Zarkon's ears. I was trying to reconcile the reason why he looked so different from so many other drools. And that made me think, maybe there's a different bloodline here. Maybe there's, it would be the equivalent of, say, a monarch in England having like the sort of goldish toned skin and almond shaped eyes that might make you think of a Southeast Asian person. You know, it's an obvious difference. Where did that come from? And that sort of sparked a whole train of thought. And Hagar herself, I wanted to like keep her in the cowl as long as possible and then have a really dramatic reveal when she finally pulled that cowl back.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to imply, and I think it actually states in there somewhere, that she is a full-blooded wyvern and that Zarkon has some wyvern blood. And it wasn't enough to, like, Lotor looks like, a taller, better-looking version of your standard drool citizen.
That's true.
But yeah, Zarkon has some earmarks. Ha, ha, ha. Slay me.
It's funny you bring that up, Dan, because in the original, your intuition is in the right place, because in the original Beast King Go Lion show from Japan, one of the big divergent plot points from Voltron is that at the climax of the series, Sincline, Lotor, has usurped his father, it's revealed that not only was Lotor the product of his father and a human female who looked very much like Allura. So it became this kind of like weird Oedipal thing. That's why he was obsessed with Allura, but didn't know it. Like he didn't know. But that Hagar, her name was Hinerva in Go Lion, was actually Lotor's grandmother. She was Zarkon's mother.
Ah.
And so at the climax of it, that's which they cut out of Voltron entirely because they couldn't show it. There's this big confrontation between Hinerva and Syncline, Lotor and Hagar, and she's like, "You've killed my son. You put him in that Robeast thing, and you sent him out to get Voltron, and you killed him, and now I'm going to kill you." Like it's this big, this big fight. I think if I recall correctly, Lotor ends up killing Hagar. He kills his own grandmother. So right. your instincts were like right in the ballpark on that one.
good. Because I never saw any of the Beast King Go Lion show.
It's a pretty fascinating ride, just much like your comic book series. So it's good narrative sensibilities on your part.
Woohoo!
Right. Okay. So going along the same lines that you were just talking about, Cryoflight asks, what inspired or guided the development of the Drools and their society?
Well, nothing about Drool society in the show really made a lot of sense to me. And I know that it was, you know, sort of the spliced together nature of it. But I couldn't ever wrap my head around how things were organized. So, I just kind of started from scratch, really. And looking back on it, I wish that I had been more creative than just numbering the kingdoms 1 through 10. I was probably facing down a typical comic book related deadline at the time. Here's the representative from Kingdom 7. I just kind of wanted to come up with something that I thought would make sense in the context of the creation that we were all putting together. What's there in the series is what I came up with. I don't know that it would, like if you tried to do a supremacy org chart, that it would really work out too well, but I was just trying to come up with something that would hold water.
Okay, we could follow that up then by saying, like, in Allura's backstory, it talks about how she had been visited by the dignitaries, and one of them was Zarkon, and it included Prince Lotor. At what point, you know, does Zarkon come up with the plan that says, okay, now is the time I'm going to strike and I'm going to take over the universe?
That might have been kind of inspired by a certain Austrian dictator, you know, like Zarkon was planning and plotting and trying to figure out exactly when the best time would be, when his forces are at their strongest and when his enemies are at their weakest. And, that the diplomatic visits to Eris could just as easily have been him doing recon, getting to know his enemies.
Okay.
So, I don't think Zarkon ever had Eris's best interests at heart.
No.
No matter what kind of face he was putting on.
Right.
Did that answer the question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You can answer this quickly for me. Is it Kogane or is it Kogane?
It's Kogane.
Kogane. Okay. That's what I thought. And that's based on the fact that he's got the Japanese and Chinese blood, right? That's where it comes from?
Yeah.
And one of the things that, you know, with Hunk, his first name is actually Japanese.
Yeah, Tsuyoshi.
Yeah. Okay. So,
I didn't want to have just a whole bunch of white people.
Yeah.
I mean, despite the skin color of the characters in the show being awfully, awfully Caucasian, I try not to come at this because I'm just like your average white dude myself.
Right.
But I try not to come at stories from a ethnocentric perspective. And it made sense to make the cast as diverse as I could while staying more or less true to the source material.
Okay. This one's a little bit of an extended question, but it comes from Cheetoy. Some fans know how Marie's story arc went, but what I'm curious about was the story arc after hers. And then there's a second part to this question. Part of me felt that the artwork after EJ Sue caused the decline in sales and that the last issue was the real nail with the hack job where pages looked as if they were slapped together last minute and by another artist. Do you think if EJ stayed with the DDP, Voltron sales would have continued, or another story arc or more? So you can answer those. Those are in like two parts there.
I think, well, my real involvement with the series pretty much comes to an end when Romel finds Sven crash landed on her planet.
Right.
After that, I think the nails were already being driven into the coffin, because at that point, I think Devil's Due had already decided that the sales were low enough that they weren't sure if they wanted to continue. And I don't remember exactly when they decided to shut it all down, but I know that after Marie's arc, I didn't hear any more about it. Like, I was out of Devil's Due. They okay. weren't telling me anything. So, I didn't have anything to do with that last issue. I am pretty sure that the pages looked like they were done by different artists, because they were. I think that in order to meet the deadline, they had to carve up the pages and just farm them all out so that they were all being drawn at the same time. I don't actually remember who wrote the last issue.
Okay.
But, yeah, it was not what I would have written.
Gotcha. Okay. That concludes the fan questions. And what I was wondering was, would you be willing to sign a copy for a fan and, pick which one of these questions you thought was, you know, interesting enough to be able to give a signed copy to one of the fans?
Well, sure. Yeah.
Okay. Who would you like to pick?
I like the one about Zarkon's ears. I don't remember who asked that, but it was the whole bloodline question.
Oh, that was when it had to do with why Hagar was the Wyvern
alien. Yeah.
It is Drowning Blonde.
Okay.
Drowning Blonde was the one who asked the question about Hagar and being a Wyvern alien.
All right. Well, it is Drowning Blonde who shall receive the signed comic then.
Thank you, Drowning Blonde, for that great question, and thank you all for submitting those questions. Now, before we go on from here, I know that Mike had talked to me before. He was mentioning something about Vehicle Voltron. What was that, Mike, you wanted to ask Dan?
I would love to see you, Dan, take on a dedicated Vehicle Voltron series of some kind in some medium, because I truly believe the fans of that show need and deserve something of quality, and I'd love to see you pen something like that. But I have no clout. I'm just a Facebook Twitter guy, so
well, I second that emotion.
So you guys wanted to see me do a vehicle thing?
Well, I'm saying that coming from a place of, as someone who found myself a Voltron fan that quickly became someone that WEP is now directly talking with and relying on, I always remind them, hey, the Vehicle Voltron fans are out there. That is a real Voltron. He had a 65 or 52 episode show. You know, they would like to see something. Let's try and give him something. We can't give him an animated show. We can't give him a movie, obviously. But can we please, you know, try and do something that's cool that brings this particular robot back into prominence? Because there were a lot of cool things about it. And if the fan base loves your work on the larger Devil's Due run, I see no reason why, you know, you wouldn't be awesome to write a Vehicle Voltron story.
Well, I'd be game.
And I'm sure there are plenty of the fans who listen to this podcast that would love to see you do that storyline where you don't go all the way with Keith and Allura and you just keep on teasing it, like, you know.
Well, forever. One of the things that I loved about the vehicle show, because I watched that just as religiously as I did the Lion show, was Commander Hawkins. And that's why I put him front and center at the beginning of the Lion story. And this is me having my own fanboy little meltdown here, but I actually got to meet Peter Cullen.
Wow.
Wow.
And, you know, I just did an interview yesterday for a website called I Smell Sheep. And I was talking about that in the interview there. But Peter Cullen was kind of like the voice of my childhood. You know, yeah. he was Venger on the Dungeons and Dragons cartoon.
Yep.
He was Eeyore in Winnie the Pooh.
Right.
He was Commander Hawkins.
Right.
And of course he was Optimus Prime. And I wrote for about 3 years, I was like the go-to guy for Transformers dialogue.
Uh-huh.
I did all the dialogue or was responsible for all the dialogue in War for Cybertron and Fall of Cybertron. And for the Transformers Prime video game, they actually flew me out to LA to sit in on the voice recording sessions.
Nice.
And I got to meet Peter Cullen, and I'm pretty sure I embarrassed myself just telling him how big a fan I was. but he's such a nice guy.
Wow.
He's just like super, super nice. And like everybody else recorded at one studio, but Peter prefers this other studio. It's kind of slightly smaller and sort of out of the way. So I took a taxi over from my hotel and met one of the producers walking up toward the studio. And we were in the parking lot. And it was like, you know, there was a Chevy and a BMW and a Nissan. And there's a Bentley. And the producer said, "Oh, Peter's here." Optimus Prime drives a Bentley.
Wow.
That's pretty crazy.
As it should be.
True.
He's shorter than you'd think he would be.
I've never actually stood against him, so I have no idea.
I've only seen him in web videos at conventions. I've never actually met him in person.
Yeah, and you know, and his regular speaking voice doesn't sound like Optimus Prime. I mean, you can tell that it's him, but he gets into character and
right.
brings out the booming bass.
Well, the funniest part of that is you know, in Vehicle Voltron, Commander Hawkins is of course the commander of the main ship,
the Explorer, isn't it?
The Explorer, right?
Yeah.
Well, in Die Rugger 15. That character is actually the William Riker of the crew.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, that's why the dude next to him, I don't remember his name on Voltron, the dude with the orange hair who sits in the chair next to Hawkins all the time, that's the captain. His name is Asimov. His name is like Commander Asimov, which is obviously a reference to Isaac Asimov.
Right.
And so when they get to the point where that character leaves and goes back to Galaxy Garrison, it's because they're calling the commander back to become part of the larger strategic command, and Hawkins' character is promoted to the head commander of the Explorer. So, but yet in Vehicle Voltron, they flipped it and gave Peter Cullen that character because he clearly has more lines, he has more scenes with the crew. He has, you know, all these, and so they smartly said, you know what, we need to give this guy Peter Cullen's voice and make him the commander because he's in more of the show. So,
you know, I heard and this may be completely false, but I heard a rumor at one point that the original plan on Star Trek: The Next Generation was for Captain Picard to be there for like 6 or 7 episodes, and then he was going to leave, and Riker was going to take over command of the Enterprise. And Patrick Stewart proved so popular that they said, yeah, that's not going to happen. We're keeping him right where he is.
Yeah, that actually was a wise move because I don't know if – I mean, with all deference to Mr. Jonathan Frakes, I don't think he may have been able to carry that show the way Patrick Stewart could have. But I digress. So,
Jonathan Frakes has shown that he can be an excellent director on many different planes.
Oh yeah, he's an amazing director. Yeah. I just say referring to the character of William Riker. I don't know if William Riker as a character could have held the audience's interest as the Supreme Commander.
Now, we'd also like to ask you, Dan, what are you working on now?
Two things in the comic industry at the moment. I created a series that was originally published by DC Comics called Bloodhound, and it got wide critical acclaim but didn't find an audience at DC, so I got the rights back from them, and after looking around for quite a while to figure out exactly what to do with it, I took it to Dark Horse Comics. So now there's a really nice collected edition of the whole DC years called Brass Knuckle Psychology. And there's a brand new miniseries coming out right now called Crowbar Medicine. For those who are unfamiliar with it, it is really nothing like Voltron. It's sort of a, I guess you could call it a superhero noir story, but it's about a non-powered detective named Travis Clevenger who specializes in tracking down superhuman villains, superhuman criminals. And these are not the kinds of criminals that put on the flashy red and yellow costumes and cackle madly. These are people who commit crimes and then just freaking disappear.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been described a little bit like the X-Files, if you replace Mulder with Conan the Barbarian.
Wow.
Because Clevenger dishes out a lot of punishment, but he also takes a lot of punishment because he's a non-powered guy facing superhumans. So just about every case he solves winds up with him in the hospital. But it is, I would say, in mainstream comics, outside of science fiction stuff, it's the best work I've done. I'm really, really proud of it.
Wow.
So, you know, if all of the Voltron fans out there could at least take a look at it, I would be very appreciative.
Well, what we'll do is we'll put the link. There's a Dark Horse Comics link,
mm-hmm.
That we had posted previously, and we will put that on the notes of this podcast.
Okay.
All right, so they can check it out.
And I believe it's starting this month, I have a 6-issue Terminator miniseries also coming out from Dark Horse.
I can guarantee you that I can put that on the Retro Blasting page that I run.
Okay.
I'd love to get a link to that and then put that there for all the Terminator fans out there. So.
And it would especially fit with retro, just the whole retro sensibility, because the entire story is set in 1985.
Perfect.
Nice.
You've got a promotional plug from my site. So.
Well, that just let the nail in the coffin, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
It was a ton of fun researching that story too, because. Stuff like the main character has a bag phone, you know, the cell phone that's so big it goes in a satchel and has a little like twisty cord that comes up to the handset.
Yep.
Because in 85, that was like cutting edge sort of James Bond level high tech.
Right.
So yeah, it was, and I'm driving the artist nuts. The penciler is Jamal Igel in fact, I worked with him on Firestorm and, I'm making him research New York in 85. And he said, I don't know what it is you've done here, Dan. You've managed to find the one time in New York history that there are no pictures of.
there was a lot of graffiti and a lot of crime.
But it's about an ex-CIA assassin, a woman named Pharaoh Green. And she encounters a Terminator. And this time... the resistance, John Connor's resistance, was not able to send back a soldier to fight it. So this is Terminator versus people in 1985 who don't know what a Terminator is.
Wow.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
That's some pretty cool stuff, Dan.
Thanks.
All right. Well, we really want to thank you for joining us today, and we're going to let you go now because you've got lots of things to do.
It's true.
But we really want to thank you for the time you've spent with us on the Let's Voltron podcast. And again, this was brought together by the fans. So this is a very fan-centered podcast. So we definitely want to do what the fans like to do. So we want to once again thank the fans for bringing Dan to our podcast. And Dan, is there anything you'd like to say to the fans one more time?
I just want to say thank you. And, you know, this has been really awesome. I really had no idea that there were this many people paying attention to the stuff that I had done. You know, you've made my month. I would love it if you all followed me on Twitter, not only because that would be cool, but also because my amount of Twitter followers is kind of sad. But I am at underscore Dan Jolly. And I will welcome any interaction, will answer any question. So, you know, feel free to find me there and say hi.
Well, you've been great to the fans so far. So I wouldn't see any reason why they wouldn't want to follow you. And we will actually post that also on the notes page for this podcast. So everybody check out Dan's work with Bloodhound and with the Terminators. We'll also post some links to the Voltron omnibus that is available on Amazon right now too.
And if you want to take a look at the other stuff that I've done, I have a Tumblr page. It's danjolly.com, and that pretty much lists everything I've ever published.
Wow. Okay, we'll check that out. All right. Mike, is there anything else you'd like to talk about before we get out of here?
No, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you, Dan. It's been a great conversation. It's nice to meet another kindred spirit in the world of sci-fi and retro. And it's also good to know that you're only a few miles away. So maybe we'll get together sometime and talk about the 80s. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Awesome.
And it would be great if we saw Dan and Wep get together again and do some more Voltron. That would be awesome.
Oh, I'm sending that email out right after this podcast.
Okay. All right. Well, that's going to do it for this week's podcast. And we want to thank all the fans for submitting the questions once again. And we'll be having more guest stars in the future. So let's Voltron.